I was attending Columbia University, getting my PhD. It was an extremely dangerous neighborhood. My roommates, who were very wealthy, would take taxis every time they had to go anywhere. But I was paying my way through school by working in Coney Island at $1 an hour for 90 hours a week, and I couldn't afford cabs. I had guard trained a Great Dane. I remember one day my wife was going to the drugstore. Some very bad-looking teenagers came into the lobby. And I had trained the dog that when Linda coughed a certain way, like that, the dog would go through the whole aggressive repertoire. Rah, 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 rah. And so she didn't like the look of those kids, especially since we didn't have any teenagers in the building. So she put the dog on guard, and they were very deferential. They held the door. They wished her a nice day. And then the next guy was mugged at razor point.
You wanted to get out of Dodge, or in this case, New York City.
Exactly.
You got hired by Colorado State University, what was this, 30 years ago?
40.
When you came to Colorado State University, it was a time where there was still a huge amount of debate about whether animals even have feelings, whether they can actually feel pain, whether they can actually have thoughts about what's happening, whether they actually suffer. And what was it that some vet science students came to you and said, did you know that we have dogs that we're required to operate on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and then we kill them?
You're just slightly wrong. It was for 3 weeks straight, Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
So it was 3 weeks.
Nine times. 3 weeks, yeah.
Operating on a dog. And any of us who have ever been through surgery knows that surgery hurts, and it's hard to recover from it. And just to save money, they were using the same dog 9 different times, and then they killed it.
Right, right. The scientific establishment, which includes as a subset the veterinary establishment, were extremely agnostic about consciousness in animals, which is a great irony because Darwin, from whom modern biology is descended, and indeed modern biomedicine, was absolutely certain that if physical traits and physiological traits and morphological traits were phylogenetically continuous, so too were psychological ones. And he wrote a wonderful book with the self-evident title of The Expression of Emotion in Man and Animal. And despite that, in the 20th century, an ideology developed that had really two major components. One, that you couldn't attribute consciousness to anything. That was behaviorism, that psychology was the study of behavior. The founder of this movement once said something very close to, we don't have thoughts, we only think we do. But anyway, there was agnosticism about consciousness in animals, and as a subset, there was agnosticism about pain. Now, I don't think I've mentioned yet that I wrote the federal laws that constrained the use of animals in research. Which was a big fight over 10 years because the research community believed that science should be completely unfettered. When they were doing very painful procedures on animals, they used no analgesics, no pain control.
And that was interesting how you explained how you figured that out by looking in the scientific literature to see how many studies had been done.
Right. Congress held a gun to my head. They said, look, you don't give us anything. The biomedical research establishment gives us a lot of money when we're running for re-election. So naturally, we don't want to antagonize them. And we really don't care about pleasing you. So if you can prove to us that they really don't do any pain control. Now, I'd gotten phone calls for years and years as I developed a reputation, largely from lab techs who just were agonized and in many cases had foreshortened careers because they couldn't stand watching the animals suffer. But I had to have hard evidence, so I went to a friend who was working in the Library of Congress as a librarian. In those days, of course, we didn't have PCs, so I asked him to take their big computer and do a literature search on analgesia, pain control, for laboratory animals. And in 82, he turned up 0 papers. So at that point, as Sherlock Holmes says, the game was afoot, so I asked him to check analgesia for animals in general. And he turned up 2 papers, one of which said there ought to be papers, and the second one said, we don't know anything, here's what we know in one paragraph. So that was able to convince Congress, particularly since their mail was coming in very strongly in favor of pain control, So we got it done. And I would like to tell your listeners about some of the paradoxical things I experienced. One time I was at the University of London doing this fancy endowed lecture, and they asked me if I would stay and comment on the next paper because it was up my alley. And this was a guy who was a very famous pain physiologist who got up and for an hour talked about the electrochemical activity in the cerebral cortex of the dog as compared with that of the person, and pointed out that the electrochemical activity was singularly different, and that therefore the dog couldn't possibly feel pain the way people do, because the cerebral cortex is the information processing portion of the brain. He talked for an hour, and I had 15 minutes to refute him, and I took three, which is unusual, because I'm long-winded, but I said, "Dr. So-and-so, if I'm not mistaken, you're a world-famous pain researcher." And he said, "Yes, thank you very much." And I said, "If I'm also not mistaken, you do your research on dogs, right?" And he said, "That's correct." And I said, "And you extrapolate the results to people?" And he said, "Yes, that's correct." I said, "Good. I have nothing else to say. Either your speech is false or your life's work is."
Said just like a philosopher.
Philosophy was good training for intellectual street fighting.
That is what you've done in your careers, intellectual street fighting. It was interesting to me reading in your book, Putting the Horse Before Descartes, that quite often you also had to use pragmatic reasons by pointing out to the researchers that if an animal's in pain, then the research that's being done, whether it's on its hormones or how it responds to shock, will be skewed by the fact that it's being put through pain.
That's right. In fact, I ended up doing an incredibly boring 2-volume book called The Experimental Animal in Biomedical Research that had about 8 papers in it on pain and pain control. Because you could get an MD-PhD at Harvard Medical School and then set up a lab using animals and never learn a thing about the animals except that they model a particular disease or syndrome. Therefore, your care of the animals was extremely dicey.
There are research papers even today saying depending on the air that's flowing through a group of rodent cages or what the temperature is or what the light is, it will affect those animals in that experiment. And you've been writing about that for years.
I wish the public knew as much as you do. I wish a lot of the scientists knew as much as you do.
Well, I've read your book.
Oh, okay. In the Bible, when the psalmist seeks a metaphor for God's ideal relationship to humans, he uses the shepherd in the 23rd Psalm, right? The Lord is my shepherd, etc. We as humans want no more from God than what the good shepherd provides the sheep. The shepherd took the animals, put them into the optimal environment that they were biologically suited for, and then helped them survive and thrive by provision of protection from predators, food during famine, water during drought, help in birthing. I just really knocked my socks off when I realized that the 23rd Psalm is as much about agriculture as it is about God.
You know, Bernie Rolland, it reads like a 4-H manual for kids.
Well, I couldn't tell you what 4-H was for most of my life, but I've been involved with that since. You know, this husbandry thing has been called the ancient contract with animals. They benefit by our ministrations, and we benefit by their product, sometimes their lives, but when they live well. In the 20th century, unfortunately, this beautiful ancient contract was broken with the rise of industrialization.
I'm thinking of the big enclosures where chickens sit side by side with their beaks cut off in foul air, laying eggs. I'm thinking of swine pens where pigs that are by nature animals that want to wander and roam and socialize are kept isolated where they can't move.
Because of air handling systems and so forth, we can get away with that, and the animals continue to produce. I'm kind of an independent guy, and I've got 250,000 miles on motorcycles. We bikers consider ranchers bros, kindred spirits. And I've gotten friendly with a bunch of them. And one time I went up there for a particular purpose, and he had invited a bunch of his fellow ranchers, and we sat around chatting at breakfast. And I asked these people, "How many of you have spent more on a calf than the calf was worth in either money or time? Because time is money." And it was 15 out of 15, you know? And what I'm referring to is when a marginal calf is born, they will bring them into the house and stay with them by the fire, you know? And they'll spend money on veterinary medicine, and they will spend their sleep time caring for the animal. So one lady was there, this was in Wyoming, and she said, "What's wrong with that, Buster?" I said, "Buster?" I said, "Well, ma'am, if I were an ag economist, I would tell you that you don't spend $20 to produce a widget that you sell for $10." And she said, she snapped at me, she said, "Well, that's your mistake, Buster. These aren't widgets. These are living things that we're responsible for."
But that's a rancher.
That's a rancher. Ranch. And those guys are the last vestiges of husbandry. And that's why I love them, and I don't want to see them go under. Now, let's contrast that with a story that I was told by one of my animal science colleagues. His son-in-law was a ranch kid, but the ranch could not sustain the five siblings. He was the youngest. He had to go to work in a pig factory. And one day he detected a disease in the baby pigs, called the boss and said, "I got bad news and good news. The bad news is they're sick. The good news is we can treat them for penny apiece." The boss says, "No, no, you don't get it. We don't treat them." The kid says, "What, you let them die of the sickness?" The boss says, "No," picks the pig up, baby pig up by the back leg, smashes the head against the concrete abutment of the pen, throws the still twitching body into a garbage heap. Well, the kid, who was brought up as a cowboy, said to himself, "That's not how I was brought up, and I can't tolerate this." So he came in on the weekend, bought the medicine with his own money, came on his own time and treated the animals, and they got better. When he told the boss said, "You're fired. You violated our policy." The kid pointed out that he couldn't be fired. He could only get a reprimand by rules of contract. So he got a reprimand. And here's the sad part, really sad. 6 months later, the guy who told me the story called me into his office and said, "Let me read you a letter from my son-in-law." And the letter went like this. "Dear Dad, I'm quitting this job. I know you're very disappointed that I'm no longer in agriculture, but this ain't agriculture. This ain't agriculture." And, you know, I've devoted my life to some projects, you know, some modest, some bigger. The modest one was to stop them using the animals over and over again in surgery, as you mentioned. We got that done. It took about 6 months. The second was to restore common sense to science through the form of pain control. So if you hurt an animal, you got to control the pain. And we got that done through the federal laws that passed in 85. And then I made a commitment to eliminate sow stalls, which, yes, you're absolutely right, are the most egregious, given the intelligence and sensitivity of pigs and given their biological natures. But you also correctly identified chickens, veal crates where they kept borderline anemic, etc. So I resolved that I would do what I could to try to eliminate these things. And I'm happy to report to you that 2 years ago, the biggest pig producer in the world, Smithfield, announced that they're phasing out those crates.
Do you eat meat?
I don't discuss that, to be honest with you, because whatever I say is wrong.
Are you willing to hang out with people who eat meat?
Of course. I mean, put yourself in my position. One of the first questions that I'm asked when I'm invited to a ranch community is, "Will you eat with us?"
And you're not going to tell me the answer.
I'll eat with them. I'll eat with them. But I don't advocate for vegetarianism. I mean, wouldn't that be a way of turning off the people I'm trying to convince, you see? Don't you think?
It sounds like you're after something that goes beyond what someone eats.
Well, what I'm after is the restoration of husbandry. And many of these cowboys have said to me, "If you're a vegetarian advocate, we cannot talk to you because you're trying to put us out of business. If you're trying to help us fix what we do, you're welcome." And they've been enormously welcoming. I am a pragmatist. Early in my career, I was much more idealistic, but one veterinarian taught me, if you're going to do animal work, you need to take stock maybe twice a year and ask yourself, are the animals any better off in virtue of what you do? And if the answer is no, he said, you're just self-gratifying, you see? The percentage of vegetarians remains pretty much the same over the last century, 5%, 7% at most. So you got 93% of the population that is going to be buying pork. And my job is not to turn them into vegetarians, but to turn the production methods into something that gives the animal a decent life.
Why is it that you named your book Putting the Horse Before Descartes? What do you have against Descartes?
Actually, I didn't know the man. Descartes is famous for affirming that animals are machines, that they had no feelings, that they had no thoughts, and thereby paved the way for people that were Cartesian, that were used Descartes' philosophy. They were doing all kinds of experimentation on animals with no anesthesia, because there wasn't any.
That was, what, at the edge of the Industrial Revolution?
Well, yeah.
He was the perfect philosopher for rationalizing what was convenient and exciting at that time in terms of discoveries, but quite a
That's
thing
right.
that he did.
You know, he was a major figure in the scientific revolution, largely known for what he did in physics and astronomy and mechanics, but he did pave the way by saying animals didn't feel pain for mechanistic physiology. And there are reports that one of his prominent disciples, when he lectured, would bring a pregnant mastiff bitch and kick her repeatedly in the stomach to remind the kids that that was just a mechanical response, like a cuckoo clock. So I've taken Descartes as the symbol of people who deny consciousness and therefore moral concern to animals.
Interestingly, you've also used other philosophers to justify where you want to have people's thinking and ethics go. So you have your team, that is the team that says...
Well said.
There are very rigorous arguments that you can get into in discussions that have to do with the logic of philosophy. Isn't it interesting that what's really motivating you is that you love animals?
Yes, that's right.
Well, in one of the examples that you, at the end of your book, talk about is you're not objecting to laboratory research with animals when it seems to serve a point, but you're objecting to unnecessary cruelty in conducting those experiments, including how a rat or a mouse or a hamster or a guinea pig dies.
Do you have pets?
I do.
You probably at some point, disagreeable though it is to remember, had to have an animal put to sleep.
You know, in my own household, that hasn't happened yet. We had an old cat who started into the dying process, and we could tell because she had lost all kinds of weight. She came home one day, and she looked like a tiny kitten inside of the big bag of a cat costume. And
okay.
We knew she was in the dying process. We asked the vet, and the vet said, you know, if she's comfortable, if she's not twitching and writhing, she's not acting like she's in pain, then you can just let her go the way that she wants to go.
So you never actually were there when you had an animal put to sleep?
No, in fact, the two of our animals who died of old age chose times where we weren't even there to go.
I like the way you put that, because my horse, I was just fearful of having to put him down, and he died on my birthday. And I'm not a mystic, but I like to think it was final gift, you know?
So I'm not against euthanasia, but we're not really talking about euthanasia when we're talking about laboratory animals. We're talking about ending their life at a certain point where in the scientific experiment it's useful for finding
out
something with science.
That's right, and that's exactly right. Now, the reason I brought up your own animals was most of us have been present when a dog or a cat is euthanized. And in modern veterinary medicine, it's really I hate to call it nice, Shelley, but it's a decent process. You know, you're petting the animal, and they give it a drug that relaxes it, and then they give it an overdose of barbiturates, so the animal simply goes to sleep. Mm-hmm. And would that that were the case with laboratory animals. And sometimes it is, maybe with dogs, with big animals. But when you got 1,000 mice to euthanize, that's very labor-intensive. So unfortunately, the approved method at the moment is carbon dioxide. Now, I will ask your listeners if they think this is a decent method of death, Buy some dry ice. Dry ice is frozen carbon dioxide. Put it in a paper bag, and for a second, stick your head in and take a breath, too. You'll get a sudden gasp, this feeling of, I got to breathe. And I don't think that that's a decent death. I don't think it's a good death. Granted, it would be inconvenient to do barbiturate injections to 1,000 mice, but still, we owe these animals a decent death, and not their last moments to be fearful, terrified, suffering from suffocation. So that's my take on that issue.
Well, and Bernie Rowland, in your book, you talk about how nobody's been able to think of a tool that allows a more humane kind of death for animals in a mass way until possibly now with some of the students you know at CSU.
We have diaries from early 19th century French balloonists who went up in balloons and recorded, this is great, we're going higher. And they went so high that they died from lack of oxygen to the brain without accumulation of carbon dioxide. We have their diaries which recorded this was a euphoric experience. And I know at least four pilots who've been through it themselves. So we were hoping that we could do that as a way of producing a non-unpleasant death in laboratory animals that have to be euthanized.
That's a complicated chamber to create where you can actually pull out the oxygen from it. But is it looking like that might be possible?
We encountered one problem. And if there's anybody listening who has any ideas on this, I'd love to get them. They go through convulsions before they die. And the question we're trying to determine is whether those convulsions are after unconsciousness or before unconsciousness. If the animals are unconscious and don't know they're having convulsions, it's not an issue. But if it is a state of consciousness that they go through before they die, that's as bad as what we're trying to replace.
In your book, Putting the Horse Before Descartes, what's your favorite story? What's your favorite memoir that you put in about an animal?
Oh, about an animal?
What of the animals that you've known, what is one of the most memorable situations where animals reminded you that they have feelings and they think and they care too?
I guess it would have to be either the story of the turkey and the guard dog or the horse that went blind.
I would choose the turkey and the guard dog myself.
Oh, is that yours?
That one's mine. Can you tell that story?
Sure. We had moved into a property in the 70s. At that point, I was beginning to travel a fair amount, including abroad. And so I was nervous about my wife being left alone because our nearest neighbor was a good half a mile. So I decided to get a watchdog. There was an ad in the paper, construction site guard dog. So we went down and looked at the dog, and his wife said, don't get that dog, he's a killer. That was just a challenge to me. So we adopted the dog, and I spent a lot of time with him bonding. His favorite game, as he bonded with my wife and myself, was to bring her a handball and present it to her, looking as guileless as a 150-pound, yellow-tusked, wolf-like German Shepherd could look. And he'd offer her the ball, and when she'd reach for it, he'd go, that he thought was humor. One day, what I thought was something prehistoric came up my driveway. It had a blue head that kept changing color, and I sort of was vaguely aware that it was a turkey, but I thought turkeys were little, and this thing was huge. The dog was known to pretty much go after anything that came on our property. I was worried about this turkey and tackled the dog and restrained him so he wouldn't hurt the bird. The fellow whose turkey it was, who lived about a half a mile up the road, came and got him, and a day later the turkey was back. Only this time, I didn't see him come. I just saw him laying on a patch of ground next to the dog. Told the neighbor, he came back and said, listen, you can keep the turkey. He's obviously attracted to the situation here. The turkey and the dog became inseparable. They'd eat out of the same dish, which is remarkable. I would take a walk. The dog would walk behind me. The turkey would walk behind the dog. Same thing when I mowed the lawn. on warm days, the dog would lie outdoors and the turkey would lie on his back, catching the sun and the warmth of body heat. And they really were inseparable. In fact, the turkey emulated the dog's behavior. When someone would drive up, the dog went ruff, ruff, ruff. The turkey went gobble, gobble, gobble. It made aggressive posture. It was pretty amusing. The dog eventually developed degenerative spinal disease, which paralyzed him. I would come home from work 5-6 times a day, move him, pet him, play with him, and so forth. Was really looking for a cue to know when he needed to be euthanized because he was losing quality of life. But during that period, my wife and I came home from the grocery. It was dark. We opened the car door, and this had to be 110-pound Malamute jumped into the car. A very friendly dog, but my wife noticed, oh my God, his mouth was covered with blood and feathers. We suspected he had attacked the turkey, jumped out of the car, followed the trail of blood and feathers to the shepherd, and between the front paws of the paralyzed shepherd was the turkey huddling for safety. And the shepherd was keeping this Malamute away by growling and threatening and so forth. And it was really quite a moment to see that kind of emotional bond crossing species. There is no way anyone could say that that was hardwired, because German shepherds are not hardwired to befriend turkeys. And so that was a very beautiful experience that, I wouldn't say it proved to me, but it reinforced in me the belief that Darwin held that emotions are continuous between humans and animals.
So there was that big old turkey, and it had been mortally wounded, but it was still alive. And it had gone to its good friend, the German shepherd.
Mm-hmm. Who was keeping the Malamute away.